Hello and welcome to episode 5 in the series of podcasts featuring two university registrars talking about higher ed stuff. Dave Hall, latterly of the University of Leicester, now the Open University, and Dr. Paul Greatrix of the University of Nottingham, that's me, talked through a number of areas of university life, including today the challenging issues around animal research, student protests and occupations, and the impact that students can have on the local communities in which they live. We look at the difficulties associated with building a new animal research facility, the desire of universities to be much more open about the research they conduct involving animals, and the benefits this brings, together with the need to engage with those holding very different views about the subject. Protests on campus are often student-led, and these can be very challenging, as with the example of student objections to a particular sculpture, which results in expletives uttered at the registrar by the protesters in one example. Whoops. Having explored why students are not snowflakes, and the success of major student-led campaigns around sexual violence and harassment and decolonisation, and the issues of student impact on local communities are also considered. University life is there in all its rich and diverse glory. Okay, welcome to another podcast in the series of university registrars talking about stuff, the imaginatively titled series, that is. I'm still very proud of that title, Dave. I don't know if you've had any positive feedback today, but it's, you know, I think it says what it does.
All the feedback has been very positive indeed, especially the title.
Very positive, all about the title. So one of the topics we were going to cover in today's adventures was around some kind of moral dilemmas or moral challenges we have in university life. And there's various reasons under legislation why we have to address issues around public meetings or speakers invited onto campus, and you've had quite a bit of experience on that front, haven't you?
Yeah, that we've had issues, as I think you have at Nottingham, where quite rightly there are some people who are concerned that we use animals in research, and we were building a new animal facility, a new animal research facility at Leicester about 10 years ago now. And we were in two minds. Do you try and put up a 20,000 square metre building secretly, or do you defend the reason why animals are still used, less so, but still used for research purposes? And I thought that we should be open and transparent about it. And so as the building went up, we obviously advised neighbours what we were doing. We put some material on our website, and colleagues who don't agree with it turned up outside the building and were protesting. They were unhappy with what we were doing, and I spoke to them, and we had a few discussions, and subsequently, after the building was opened, and they did make valiant efforts to stop us opening it, mainly by irritating the contractors. But we invited some of them into the facility. We showed some of them around at what we were doing. We invited Radio 4 in, and they came in.
This was once it had been populated with animals.
This was once the research had started.
Yeah.
And I think we were the first university to have some research involving a rat, an operation on the rat, televised.
Oh, wow.
And we got a lot of plaudits in the science media for defending what we were doing, arguing the case for using animals under the strict regimes, and obviously under which we do involve animals in research. And the protesters, the antis, didn't return. Although we did have a debate on campus with them, one of my colleagues in the politics department doing research into animal welfare and animal rights. And again, we had no trouble. They were quite right that they were expressing their views. And it is a morally difficult area. I can fully understand why people don't agree with it. And there was a time in my life when I didn't agree with it. But some of the research that we've been doing involving animals has transformed things like how we deal with liver cancer, how we look at blood pressure, cardiovascular issues. And so I think that it's been productive.
So did they protest throughout the entire construction of the building then?
No, they there was initial protests, protesting physically on the campus, but the main activity resorted to try and disrupt the contractors on other sites.
Oh, right.
Because our site was, because of the presence of protesters, was quite secure. So they went to other sites in which the contractors were working. And when we'd been completed and we were looking at the security issues, one thing I was concerned about is that part of the site was open to the cemetery, which the campus is by. And so I'd asked that we did some defensive planting along there, rather than putting up a big steel fence that we used. We were imagining our use of plants, so there was obviously going to be a lot of pyracantha and holly and that sort of thing. And so they told me that they'd done the defensive planting. And I thought, well, that's impressive. They'd done that over a weekend. And so I popped down to have a look at it. And there it was. You know, 2-inch high pyracantha, which in 5 to 10 years would secure,
have grown into
would be
a secure
boundary.
Yeah. Well, if it had been Leylandia, of course,
yes,
it would have grown in 10 minutes. But yes, natural planting does take time, doesn't it, to have an effect. So they didn't actually succeed in disrupting the building or its operations thereafter?
No, it was... I don't think it was... As I recall, it wasn't delayed. But I think it was right that we were open about what we were doing and engaged with that lobby.
And there has been, I mean, across universities working on animal research, there has been greater openness over the past decade or so, and you were obviously at the forefront of that. But and there has been, although, you know, the numbers are released every year of animal procedures, and it looks like there have been more procedures. The general trend is downwards, I think, or at least the trend of increasing work on animal models rather than animals themselves.
Yes.
That's certainly growing. And the refinement and reduction of animal use generally, thanks to the work of NC3Rs, the National Committee, is progressing well, and that has been really influential, certainly at Nottingham.
There have been undoubtedly a lot of money put into alternative research methods and technologies, allowed huge advances to take place. And when I was saying there's been a decline, certainly at Leicester we've seen a decline, partly the way the research strategy's gone. But money's been available to it, and there have been problems identified with the animal model.
Yeah.
And the translation into humans, which has again inspired investment into surgical alternatives.
But I do think your point about making people aware of the science that arises from animal work is really, really important, because you know, a huge amount of incredibly valuable science does emerge, which is ultimately very, very beneficial to human existence, and that simply wouldn't happen were it not for this research being conducted.
Yeah, science is still needs a living organism in which to understand the mechanics of life, if you like, and how to understand the mechanics of disease within a living organism. And I think it's quite right and proper that we're no longer testing makeup and cosmetics and shampoos and whatnot on animals. I mean, that was a shocking thing for industry to be doing, and that's quite right that now that is has been stopped thanks to the animal lobby.
Yeah.
But no one would walk into a hospital and say, "Please treat me with procedures and drugs which have not been tested on animals."
No. No, indeed. And I think that, you know, there is a very, very clear dividing line between the, you know, the kind of superficial cosmetic stuff and the, you know, the human need around medical care and prevention. It remains an ongoing challenge, though, doesn't it? Because, you know, although one may be very transparent about what's going on in these facilities, the work that's done, the number of animals used, the procedures that are undertaken, and we can publish things on our websites, etc., and indeed invite people to visit, which does happen. Nevertheless, it's not a completely open facility, is it? Because if it were, then anyone could stroll in off the street and do something Troublesome.
True. I suppose the facility is secure for a couple of reasons, but partly is that yes, not everybody would be willing to visit in the spirit of inquiry, yeah, shall we say, but also because the animals have to be housed in the sort of conditions that the research requires. Normally a very high health status, so there's restrictions on how humans and researchers interact with the animals, just as there is in a hospital.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It has to be a highly clean and specialised facility.
Yeah. Yeah. So thinking more broadly then about, so that's one example really of where, you know, you get protest and opposition to university activity. I mean, we're often in the position where, you know, other protests are happening on campus as well. I mean, we're in a position, you know, while we're recording this, we're in the middle of a dispute and strike action by members of UCU. But normally it's students who are doing the protesting. And I wonder, I mean, have you had any experience of student protests in your university career which have caused challenges to university operations? I'm sure you remember, you know, occupying buildings when you were a student.
Yes, there was a time when I was a student, so I got every sympathy with, and it's quite right that students engage with protest and political issues, and are passionate and committed about it. I think it's the sort of thing you would expect and want to see on university campuses. I mean, it's a sign of a healthy democracy, yeah, and a healthy education system. But it is a dilemma for those of us who are trying to manage an environment, a learning environment at the same time. But certainly when I was a student and tuition fees and loans were first being introduced, I was president of the student union at Reading, and inevitably we had a demonstration on campus, and I led a band of students to White Knight's House, which was the administrative building at Reading, and we were going to occupy it, although we hadn't brought anything, any food or anything appropriate to do that. And I was tasked to march up to the Vice Chancellor's office and make our demands. I must admit, I was pretty pleased that his office was locked when I got up to the top floor, and that they'd barricaded themselves in, because he wasn't a man to have a confrontation with. Dr. Ewan Page, he was a very forceful figure. Anyway, we stayed there for a few hours, made our point, and then retired back to the Students' Union for a cup of tea.
And that kind of creativity has been sustained by Students' Unions down the years, I think. There is an issue about creativity in student protest, and I'm always impressed when I do see something which is more creative. One of the areas, of course, where students these days are much more successful than universities, it seems to me, is in campaigning online through social media, where they're able to have a much stronger effect on perceptions of an institution than they are necessarily by just occupying the Vice Chancellor's office, which may get a short-term headline gain and may make the small number of people doing the occupation feel pretty good, but actually doesn't have a huge effect. Whereas, you know, a good social media campaign can reach an awful lot more people than just an occupation of a room.
Yeah, I think the students, what irritates me is the attitude of some parts of the media that students are snowflakes, and yet what they've done in terms of exposing sexual violence and mistreatment of women, racism within the curriculum, as a really challenging and important issues, and that thousands of students have got engaged with this, and they are making a real difference. The idea they're snowflakes is a disgrace, when the kind of commitment that I've seen students display through the Me Too campaign and through certainly, yeah, less of the work around decolonisation of the curriculum and engaging with those sort of issues is changing the sort of education that we're delivering. Yeah. And I think it's fundamental, and the students themselves have been delivering it.
I absolutely agree with you. I think the kind of snowflake description is genuinely, you know, misguided and unfair and just not borne out by the evidence. I mean, there are plenty of examples of students organising themselves in order to create environments in which everyone participating can feel safe and secure. And I see absolutely no problem with them doing that. And it is perfectly reasonable for people to join in campaigns to end sexual harassment and violence in university environments. I think that's perfectly legitimate. But yeah, the idea that they're all snowflakes is just completely misguided.
Not everybody agrees in our own communities, of course. We had students demonstrating a few years ago because we were installing a sculpture.
Yeah.
And they're concerned.
That sounds quite innocuous, a sculpture.
Well, it was why are we wasting tuition fees on sculptures?
Right.
So that was the angle, which is a fair point. The only problem was, of course, it was a donated piece of art, so it didn't cost anything. And when I did point this out to the students who were protesting, and they said, well, who's paying for the insurance? Who's paying to get it installed? So, you know, they got a point. I couldn't get out of it. But the students were protesting. And there was this unveiling, and one of my retired colleagues said, "Registrar, go and tell them to go away. Go and get rid of those protesting students." So, you know, I said, "Fair enough." And I walked over to the group of students, and one of them had a loud hail, and I said, "There's no chance of you stopping that, is there?" And we had a short conversation, and I walked back over to the colleagues who were doing the unveiling, and the chap said to me, well, what did they say? I said, well, they told me to fart. What do you think they were going to say?
Well, it's perhaps an unsurprising, although, you know, perhaps insufficient respect for the office of registrar in those circumstances, but perfectly understandable. Although I have to say, in my experience, any student protest has been, uniformly respectful and well behaved in recent years that I've noticed. Although I do remember days from protests when we were both working at the University of Warwick, Dave, where students, you know, appeared to occupy Senate House at the drop of a hat. And always managed to get in before anyone was able to lock the doors. But I do remember, part of the strategy in responding to that was to shut the toilets, you know, on the assumption that therefore they would all leave if they had to go to the loo, which never worked, of course, because, you know, that's what waste paper bins are for, isn't it? So,
I think the best strategy is to allow the protest to take place for a period of time. When we had, the administrative building was occupied, I brought in duvets and cushions for the students to sleep on. We looked after them, security were there, the toilet was available, they had some food brought in, and what drove them out was boredom.
Yeah.
In the end, and actually the things that they were asking for were fairly reasonable, and we had a productive conversation about it, and I think that strengthens the relationship between the students and the executive when you're able to see each other's perspective and see what you can do to accommodate it.
One of my favourite incidents from a student occupation a few years back was an occupation which ended by our security team evacuating the students from the lecture theatre they were occupying. Why they'd occupied the lecture theatre, I still don't entirely know. But one poor student, one lad who'd been, out for the evening instead of being occupying, returned just to find that everyone else had left the building and demanded to be readmitted so he could claim his cafetiere from inside the lecture room where he'd left it. And you can understand his distress. But these things are sent to challenges, and I'm slightly reluctant to sound too confident about our abilities to deal with student protest, because you never know how creative and exciting the next one will be, and how incapable we will be of responding to it. But hopefully, it's not as challenging as it might be.
I think the difficulty is being able to respond to legitimate concerns fast enough.
Yeah,
that you might and to be able to get the bureaucracy of the organisation to manoeuvre itself and to go through the appropriate channels to change procedures and policies and authorised investments, that you know, I can understand the students want it doing, you know, overnight sort of thing, and you know, it's going to take 6 months, and they think you're delaying so that you can get the next lot of students in. And
although I mean, you know, our procedures are slow, but most student unions' bureaucratic procedures are Byzantine in compared with universities. In my limited experience, apologies to student union activists out there. I'm sure they're all streamlined now. I mean, while we're on kind of students and their behaviour, and accepting that the vast majority of students are actually very focused on their studies and very sensible and well-behaved all the time, one of the challenges we get periodically is, particularly where we've got large concentrations of students living in the local community in shared houses, where there is a high density of students, they are often cited as, you know, having parties in the early hours and keeping other residents up into the following morning and causing a mess and disturbance in general. This is commonplace across the country in areas of high densities of student occupation. And you must have found that in your time in Leicester as well. But, I mean, it is a challenge because they are citizens, they are residents too. Part of what we're trying to do is educate them to behave sensibly in those environments, but every now and then they are gonna make a noise, and that can be very disruptive.
Yeah, there is a tension between local residences and local residents and students and the university, in the sense that I know from working with residence groups, they would like us to police the students while they're in the community, and we have limited powers to do that, although I think I've seen over the years I've been involved, we are far more proactive than we used to be in employing staff to go out and talk to students.
Yeah.
There are initiatives like, and which actually this is a student union led one, I think, they gave all students in private accommodation tea bags to encourage them to have a cup of tea with their neighbour.
Oh, with their neighbour, rather than just giving them tea.
No, they weren't. Any idea was you went down to your neighbours and you had a cup of tea and you got to know each other. And I think that did work. Where we, I'm sure you have the same, at the end of term, encouraging students to just use the amount of bins that are available and not just to leave rubbish everywhere. But those sort of things can work well if you're working with the residence groups. And I think once we all know that we're all on the same side and we have got to live together, and the students do put a lot of money into local economies, they create quite interesting cultural areas, you know, in terms of the types of shops that come up and the bars and the restaurants and that. It can enliven an area. But it can be difficult for those, you know, where you've got several student houses on a street and people are working and there's late night parties and that. And I do think, I would say these days, that the university has got a responsibility to try and work with both parties to get the students to live properly in the community, but also for the residents to understand that we can't arrest them, we can't police them in that way.
I think that's absolutely right. And and of course, students do not only those economic and cultural benefits you described, but they do bring an awful lot to an area, and you know, a lot of them are, you know, doing volunteering as well as, you know, kind of collecting that end of term material for recycling for various charities, etc. I think part of the issue is that all of that is just wiped away when there's a noisy party, or, you know, someone's, you know, son or daughter is woken up the night before a school exam or whatever it might be. It can have a really disproportionate impact, and the pressure on public services at the moment, both police and local authorities, means that, you know, they're ill-equipped to respond to, you know, quite reasonable residents' concerns about behaviour, and therefore it appears to fall to the university to solve what is a, you know, not necessarily directly the university's issue. So I think that's, for me, where the biggest challenge comes, is, you know, dealing with the inadequacies of public finances to try and meet the reasonable requests of residents to, you know, to have a good night's sleep. And as you say, though, it comes down to continuing dialogue, continuing to meet with residents' associations, etc., to try and assuage their concerns and to educate our students.
We've definitely been, universities have been called on to fill a public funding gap, thanks to the billions that have been taken out of local governments, as you say, and local services. So with the police wanting us to play for police, policing of the campus and the local areas, the social services, mental health services, rape crisis centres, and, you know, we do the best we can, but we are being, it is showing how poorly resourced many of our public services are.
Yeah. Well, so on that note of poor funding, we'll leave it there for this time, but thank you again, Dave, for stimulating discussion.
Thanks.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until the next time.